a great pleasure to introduce Ros Wright QC.
Well, very nice to see everybody here. This is Sybil Campbell, if you can see her, because I haven't got any slides. That's Sybil Campbell. Sybil Campbell was the first woman judge. In fact, she was the first woman stipendiary magistrate, which comes to the same thing, because she was a full-time judicial appointee, and she sat at Tower Bridge Magistrates Court. And for those of a certain age, like me, we can just about remember her. In fact, she was appointed in 1945, and she went on sitting until 1961. So you have to be of a certain age to remember her. She was a contemporary of Helena Normanton, and she was one of the, what I call the Magnificent Ten, the 10 women who were all called simultaneously to the bar on the 17th of November, 1922. And she was the first woman to be called that night, in fact, by Middle Temple. Many of the women who were called that night, there were nine at Middle Temple and one at Inner Temple, 6 months after the very first woman who was called to the bar, who was Dr. Ivy Williams, they didn't practice, and their groundbreaking achievements ended at call. But Sybil Campbell was a notable exception. She had a distinguished legal forebear. She was the granddaughter of Sir William Beauvill, who was the Chief Justice of the Common Pleas, who presided at the famous Tichborne Claimant case. She was born in Ceylon in 1889. She was the eldest of three daughters. She was educated at home by her mother, and from the age of 13 at a private school in Scotland in North Berwickshire. She studied natural sciences part one and then economics for part two at Girton. She was a contemporary of Elsie Bowerman and Maud Crofts, who entered Girton in the same year, who were also legal pioneers, and made them near contemporaries of Carrie Morrison, who was the first woman solicitor who arrived at Girton in 1907. Elizabeth Cruikshank, who you may know well, we all know her in the first 100 Years Project. Elizabeth Cruikshank wrote that it seemed quite an extraordinary achievement for one college to produce two of the first women barristers and two of the first women solicitors, especially as it was certainly not a requirement to have a university degree before entering the solicitor's profession. Now, Sybil Campbell didn't exactly distinguish herself as an academic. She took a third in both parts of her degree. And in 1913, she sought employment as an investigating officer for the trade boards, with responsibility for enforcing minimum wages in what were called the sweated trades, made up largely of the garment and boot-making industries, typified by long working hours and poor working conditions. And she held that role for 5 years until 1918, and she prosecuted her own cases in that time. Not, of course, as a lawyer, because it was before women were allowed to go to the bar. She was then employed in a similar role, this 1918, after the war, gaining additional courtroom experience with the Ministry of Food, policing the food controls imposed during the latter stages of the First World War. Those restrictions came to an end in 1921, when she finally left the Ministry of Food to read for the bar. She secured a tenancy in the chambers of somebody called H.H. Joy. And in 1922, pupillage was not a mandatory requirement, and there's no record of Campbell's having served a formal pupillage. But she practiced on the Midland Circuit for 7 years, devilling for Mr. Joy, and performing on one occasion at least to a sufficiently high standard of advocacy to impress the trial judge, who was Finlay J, in a breach of promise case. In 1929, however, still retaining her seat in chambers, she joined the panel of appointed members of the trade boards determining wages for low-paid workers as the impartial member of four boards. In 1930, she was appointed as an independent member of the courts of referees, hearing appeals against the refusal of unemployment benefit. They were paid posts and they kept her quite busy. She sat on at least three referees' courts a week, sometimes as many as nine. At the outbreak of the Second World War, she went back to her old role, albeit at a superior level at the Ministry of Food, and she was appointed Assistant Divisional Food Officer Enforcement for London. Patrick Polden, who's written extensively about Sybil, notes that she was described in the popular press as Britain's number one food detective and the directing brain behind the organisation that trapped food profiteers and black market racketeers. Polden himself calls her a ruthless hunter of black marketeers. And for this work, she was awarded an OBE in 1942. She left the ministry in 1944 and went back to Chambers, from which she applied, probably by invitation, for appointment as a magistrate in what were then known as the police courts. There was a vacancy at Tower Bridge, and in March 1945, and Campbell's application appears to have been the only one to merit serious consideration. The Home Secretary, who was Herbert Morrison, consulted the Lord Simon, who's the Lord Chancellor, directly for his sanction for her appointment. And Lord Simon seems to have had the advantage of some inside knowledge, writing to Morrison. Campbell lived for a long time with another public-spirited lady, the headmistress of a London school, whom I have known since I was a child, and all this predisposes me in her favour. So she was appointed. She was appointed as Metropolitan Police stipendiary magistrate, and that was announced on the 3rd of April 1945. She became the first woman to sit, as I mentioned, as a full-time salaried judge in the courts of England and Wales. Women had sat as JPs since 1919, but the role was, of course, and is voluntary and is a part-time one. Well, Campbell's role in the court of referees could be classified as a judicial appointment, but the post again wasn't full-time. But with her appointment as a stipendiary magistrate, she broke new ground as a legal pioneer. Appointments to the bench were the province of the Lord Chancellor on the recommendation of the Home Secretary, and although applications were invited in the interwar period for appointment to junior judgeships, including the magistracy and the county court, none were forthcoming from women. Applicants would have had to support their application for the bench by confirmation of their extensive experience at the bar, and by 1939, necessarily less than 17 years after the first woman was called to the bar, this would have amounted to a less than impressive body of evidence. Her appointment inevitably drew critical comment from parts of the professional press. The Law Journal questioned whether, in view of the hearing of very unpleasant matters, which a magistrate would inevitably be faced with, this was a suitable post for a woman. There were also objections from members of the bar, made through the Chief Metropolitan Magistrate, Sir Bernard Watson, which were published in a letter to the Times. Hansard, for the 12th of April 1945, records a parliamentary question from a Dr. Russell Thomas MP, asking the Home Secretary on what grounds he departed from precedent in appointing a woman to be a Metropolitan Stipendiary Magistrate. Other objections were not directly linked to her sex, although this ground may have been veiled. One was the government's apparent tendency to man the judiciary with members of the executive, to which response was made that Campbell's was the third such appointment, and to exclude such persons might eliminate some of the strongest candidates. The second objection was that under the provisions of the Metropolitan Police Act of 1839, police magistrates were obliged to have practised as a barrister during at least 7 years, then last past, and Campbell, while at the ministry and as a referee, didn't appear to have done so. The Attorney General, Sir Donald Somerville, ingeniously argued that she had contributed throughout her career towards the remuneration of her clerk in Chambers. And the government spokesman also asserted that she hadn't been debarred from accepting briefs while undertaking her peacetime appointment, although, of course, she didn't actually take any on. And rather more questionably, she might indeed have accepted instructions as a barrister while she was working full-time as an assistant divisional food officer with the consent of her superiors. Sir Frank Newsom, then Deputy Under-Secretary of State at the Home Office, wrote, "I can think of nothing more likely to shake public confidence in a judge or stipendiary than hostile comment as to his suitability for appointment." And the Permanent Secretary, Sir Alexander Maxwell, agreed, "It's tempting to say that you thought it high time for the Metropolitan Bench to have the advantage of a woman member, but the danger is that such a reply will draw the question, did you appoint Miss Campbell because she's a woman and not because she was the best candidate available?" And in any event, Morrison's reply was, "It would be contrary to precedent to detail the reasons for any advice tendered to His Majesty. I can, however, say that I was and am satisfied that Miss Campbell possesses qualities which will make her a valuable addition to the Metropolitan Bench." It might have been more apposite to observe that Campbell's legal experience was mostly that of a prosecutor and investigator, and may thus have been considered to produce a bias towards the prosecution when on the bench. In the late 1970s and 1980s, applications to the stipendiary magistracy from former members of the DPP staff were rejected precisely because of this fear of one-sidedness, despite there having been at least two successful appointments of magistrates from the senior ranks of the DPP's office. In fact, one of them, David Hopkin, became chief magistrate. Sybil Campbell took her seat on the bench at Tower Bridge for the first time on the 23rd of April 1945. The only training she'd received was to observe a day's hearing on two occasions at two different police courts. Her appearance was that of a benign headmistress. Stella Hollis, who was Stella Heidelman, some of you may remember her, who appeared before her as counsel, recalls her as small, with short grey hair and a fearsome reputation. The fearsome reputation was to show itself quickly. By October 1945, widespread criticism was being received from the areas of South London covered by the jurisdiction of Tower Bridge Court for her seemingly heavy sentences for first offenders. The South London press reported cases such as that of William Head, awaiting his discharge after 27 years in the army, who was given a prison sentence by Campbell for stealing three and tuppence worth of brewer's saccharin from his employers. Henry Lucas, who'd served 35 years with his employer, was jailed by Campbell for stealing four small Christmas puddings. Charles Bird, whom she sentenced to 6 weeks in jail for stealing butter, and James Drummond, Ethel Watson, Ada Graham, who was a crippled widow, each received 3 months imprisonment for the theft of cloth, underwear, blankets, tablecloths, and something called plastic triangle head coverings, worth in all less than £30. By October 1945, protests against what were perceived to be her heavy sentencing and treatment of first offenders started to come in earnest. One protester sent a postcard addressed to Chief Clerk, Home Office, Belson Chambers, Whitehall, London South West, and wrote, "Public opinion should make you remove old woman Campbell from Tower Street bench. Instead of your department hanging five innocent Germans at Pentonville last week for nothing, why not hang or gas an inhuman woman who has caused so much more pain?" But the files reveal Campbell's softer side. On the 8th of October in 1945, the Evening News reported that she'd bound over for a year a Manx private in the parachute regiment who'd been charged with receiving a stolen bicycle. Very patiently, the paper wrote, Miss Campbell disentangled the intricate details of a rather complicated story. When it was all sorted out and the officer had spoken highly of the young soldier, she told him she'd given the benefit of his previous good character and his war record. The following day, the Daily Mail noted that at the end of a day's hearing in Campbell's court, with 13 cases up before her, the Black Maria went away empty, for no prison sentences had been passed that day. And it should be said that on that occasion, the press gallery in her court was unusually full, with reporters on the scent of any unduly harsh sentences. Whether this influenced her sentencing on the 8th of October, it's now impossible to say. Tudor Ede, the Labour Home Secretary who succeeded Herbert Morrison when the Labour government was elected in 1945, called for a report from the police division covering Tower Bridge Court, which showed that when the national figures for magistrates in 1945 were of all those tried summarily, 23% of cases were dismissed, bound over or put on probation, 53% fined and 23% jailed. Campbell's figures, by comparison, were 24% dismissed, bound over or put on probation, 32% fined and 44% jailed, a very much heavier recourse to imprisonment than the national average. Campbell, not surprisingly, received full support from the police, who were not at all dismayed by the trend in sentencing at Tower Bridge Court. They sought to justify the sentences, pointing out that they had a deterrent effect and that there were aggravating features in some of the cases. A Home Office official took a different view and observed that, "I think we can say that Miss Campbell, possibly in view of her experience at the Ministry of Food, is apt to deal more severely with offences in connection with goods that are rationed or in short supply, but when the accused is legally represented, she is a little apt to acquit when we should expect a conviction. The clear inference is that an unrepresented defendant received a raw deal at her hands, especially where thefts of food were concerned, but in the presence of legal representation for the defence, Campbell was what is called in the trade somewhat of a pushover." Her sentencing policy did not go unremarked locally. She was booed on her way to court, called names such as the Beast of Belson. Appeals against her sentences for the most part succeeded, with small fines being substituted for the prison sentences that she imposed. Four women porters on the Southern Railway who'd been given prison sentences for theft of shampoo, face cream and face powder had their sentences commuted to a £5 fine. The heavy sentences, however, continued and raised the ire of local workers. She sentenced Waterloo porter Arthur Whiffin to 6 weeks in prison for stealing three bars of soap, which was said to have led to a demonstration of 5,000 factory workers in protest. William Connor, the influential columnist of the day, writing in the Sunday Pictorialist Cassandra, observed that Sybil Campbell looks like Auntie, your auntie, my auntie. But at Tower Bridge, Auntie always says no, softly pushes open the dungeon door, smiles sweetly, and another wrongdoer begins his penance. Cassandra's piece raised a storm of angry protests against Campbell. She was a fiendish vixen displaying vindictiveness towards unfortunates, and the Home Secretary should chuck her out into the Thames. Local union branches called her harsh, brutal and unreasonable, and together with the ward of the local Labour Party, the British Humanitarian League and even the Women's Cooperative Guild called for her dismissal. Her obituary in the Times on September 1, 1977 refers to a callow local MP who demanded her removal from the bench and received a predictably and deservedly dusty answer from the Home Secretary. She was not without her contemporary supporters, however. The Evening Standard of the 20th of January 1947 wrote that the agitation against Miss Campbell is growing into a vendetta, and it needs in all fairness to be said that a vendetta is neither justified nor wise. The article suggested that her critics may have had ulterior motives, possibly misogynistic, and that the Temple grapevine has been whispering about her from the start, and that no comparable criticism had been made of an equally severe sentencer, the Greenwich magistrate, Mr. J.F. Eastwood, who passed heavy sentences on thefts from the workplace. And Mrs. W. Bland from Bermondsey wrote to the Home Office that the dockers were out to force her resignation or transfer to cover up large-scale pilfering from the docks. She observed, "I've had to receive some judgment from her, and a more just and fairer woman it would be hard to find anywhere on earth. No, these wretched breakers of law and order cannot take their medicine." And Hilda Lincott, writing from Surbiton, observes, "She is doing a fine job in endeavouring to arrest the appalling rate of petty thieving which is destroying this country." Even Cassandra noted in his lengthy piece that she is very polite to the prisoner in the dock. "Will you sit down, Mr. Gray? He got 4 months last Thursday." The campaign against her began to recede as people struggled through a dreadfully harsh winter in 1947, and perhaps sympathy for thieves, even petty thieves, of food, coal, and clothing moderated. It also became known that some of Campbell's first offenders were not first offenders at all. The Times obituary that I've already mentioned cites her own view of her conduct. Sybil Campbell herself was quite unmoved by all the excitement. She had the courage of her convictions and of her sentences. But as conditions in the post-war period slowly returned to normal, she felt that it was less necessary to impose such exemplary punishments, and the limelight and hostility which she had first attracted gradually faded away. The obituary also goes on to say sympathetically that as the years went by, she gained the respect and even the affection of the local population. On her last day in court, she wore a spray of violets given to her by a barrow boy admirer. She continued to sit at Tower Bridge until 1961, when she attained the statutory retirement age of 72. It's noteworthy that during the almost 17 years in which she sat as a magistrate, no other woman was appointed to the stipendiary bench, or indeed to any other full-time judicial post in the courts of England and Wales. Indeed, the next woman after Campbell to be appointed to a full-time judgeship after Campbell was Elizabeth Lane, who was appointed a county court judge in 1962. Did Campbell's reputation and the criticism that her sentencing attracted have a direct effect in delaying the recruitment of women to judicial posts? It should be remembered that by the 1940s and 1950s, very few women barristers had managed to attain sufficient experience or seniority to qualify them for the bench. Those who had, and there were some remarkable exceptions, Rose Heilbronn and Helena Normanton herself, preferred to build up their careers at the bar, in silk, rather than seek appointment as a puny judge. It's unfair to smear Campbell with the accusation that the failure to appoint women to the bench in her direct wake should be laid entirely at her door. Sybil Campbell's career, even by today's standards, with the recognition now given to employed barristers as on an equal status with their self-employed colleagues, was unusual for appointment to the bench. She achieved, I'm afraid, very little of note as a courtroom advocate, but was a hard-working and committed civil servant, a dedicated and firm pursuer of black marketeers and bad employers. She adopted a stern stance as a magistrate. The headmistress' description seems to have fitted her well, perhaps thinking this was expected of her, and that to show excessive signs of feminine compassion and sympathy would be accounted a weakness. She did have her softer side, however. The press noted that her nephews and nieces are often in court to watch Auntie Sybil dispensing justice. She was unwavering in her disregard of often outrageous insults, but she did have a lighter side. The vicar, the Reverend Andrew Duncan Jones, giving the oration at her funeral in 1977, refers to her sharp mind and gifted tongue. She was a skilled talker, never a chatterer, but a talker, and this was how she kept up with her friends. Right up until her last days, her telephone bills were prodigious. And when she was in the mood, what an incomparable raconteur she was. How many of us have been reduced almost to tears or to helpless laughter by her skillfully told anecdotes. Well, Sybil Campbell was the first woman judge. She had no female role model and instinctively dealt severely with those whose actions she regarded as damaging to the greater good. She was motivated by a strong work ethic and a moral sense. She certainly didn't go out of her way to court public affection. Courting a favourable public image for members of the bench, and indeed the legal profession as a whole, would have been regarded as totally alien to her and to her contemporaries. This doesn't make her a bad magistrate, and I don't believe she was. We should celebrate her groundbreaking achievement as the first woman judge. Thank you.